Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of NatureNow at kptz.org. So hello, and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Nan Evans, and in the studio with me today is a local naturalist, Steve Grace. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Nan. Great to be with you.
It's fun to be here. And we will be talking about a very special cruise we took this past Saturday in search of tufted puffins. But first, let's hear this week's mystery sound. Growls and whistles. Well, we'll come back to the mystery sound a little later in the program. But first, let me set the stage for my conversation with Steve. Every Saturday evening from now through August the 10th, the good people at Puget Sound Express are partnering with the Port Townsend Marine Science Center to offer a three-hour cruise to look for tufted puffins and other seabirds and mammals of the Salish Sea. Last Saturday, Steve Grace was the naturalist leader on board, along with Johanna King and myself as the Marine Science Center volunteer hosts. The weather was beautiful, sunny and warm. 50 people, visitors from afar, as well as local residents, joined the excursion aboard the Glacier Spirit. Of course, the Glacier Spirit is considered by many to be the most beautiful and relaxing boat in our Pacific Northwest Whale Watch fleet. Passengers love the comfortable inside seating and the large viewing windows. There's a snack bar and galley and two restrooms and an outside viewing deck all around the entire cabin. She's also equipped with fully modern navigation equipment and indoor and outdoor speakers. Well, we set off from the dock at Port Hudson about 6 o'clock. Equipped with cameras, everything from point-and-shoot to those long-lens telephoto cameras, and of course, binoculars. Captain Chris Hanke, who's the grandson of Puget Sound Express founder, Pete Hanke Sr., knew that tufted puffins had been recently regularly observed on the bluffs of Smith Island. Well, a quick poll of passengers decided that the possibility of puffin sightings outweighed our original planned destination of Protection Island. So off we went to Smith Island. Now, you may not be familiar with Smith Island. Smith and the nearby Minor Island are about midway between Admiralty Inlet, that's right off our shore here, and Lopez Island. It's about 5.5 miles west of Whidbey. And the islands are part of the San Juan Islands National Wildlife Refuge. Smith Island Light was constructed on the island in 1858. Originally, this stood about 200 feet away from the island's western edge, but the bluff began to erode. And when the bluff reached the front door, and that was in the 1950s, the lighthouse was abandoned. Today, all that is left is a small, long-abandoned house and an automated navigational light and weather station. Well, along the route to Smith Island, we spotted stellar sea lions lounging on a navigational buoy with nesting pelagic cormorants in the buoy's superstructure. Then the seabird spotting picked up. And getting closer to the western bluffs of Smith Island, we could see gaping holes in the upper layers of the bluff. So, Steve, talk to me about those holes. What are they?
Yeah, those holes. So those are burrows for the tufted puffin, also for the rhinoceros auklet. So both of those birds are, they're seabirds, but they can't nest on the water. They have to nest on land. And the tufted puffins and the rhinoceros auklets, they have that nesting habits of digging burrows, long burrows.
So they dig the burrows. How do they do that?
They do, yeah. Well, they use those, the puffin uses that beautiful beak. It has that big orange signature beak that makes it look like a toucan or a parrot.
Yep.
So that has a lot of functions. It can hold a lot of fish. That's one thing the tufted puffin's famous for. It's also, it's laterally compressed, meaning it's thin like a hatchet. So they use that bill to chop into the earth and loosen it up. And then they kick the dirt out with their big webbed feet, kind of like my Labrador digging in the ground.
Yeah, you're right. So are the burrows deep?
They are deep. So they can go 5, 6 feet, even more, sometimes up to 10 feet. And they're pretty elaborate constructions. They have a little chamber at the end where they lay one egg. And when that egg hatches, it's a baby puffin, which is known as a puffling.
Pretty cute, right?
A puffling.
Yeah, how cute is that?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. And there's kind of some side chambers that are like bathroom areas. And the puffling has a cozy little nook in the back, which is lined with soft feathers and grass.
So the puffling has to get out of its burrow and learn to fly. How does that happen?
That's right, yeah, and that's part of the puffin's amazing story. So that little puffling, so it's it takes about 6 weeks or more for the parents to incubate the egg. When that egg hatches, it takes about 6 weeks, maybe 7 weeks, for that little puffling to fledge, to grow its flight feathers and be ready to take off and fly out to sea. So the parents have to bring it back fish, and they stay really busy flying back and forth, carrying multiple fish in those big orange bills that they have, and feeding that little puffling, just stuffing it full of fish so it gets a lot of calories and grows up strong, and then it molts its downy feathers and grows its flight feathers, and then it's ready to go. And one day, it just takes off under instinct. The parents don't teach it. They don't train it. That little puffling doesn't get a chance to practice. It just goes out to sea.
It's up there on the cliff.
It's up there on
the cliff. Yeah,
there it is. And all it's known is that subterranean world. It's just been hidden back there in that burrow because it's safe back there. It's safe from land predators if they can get out there. It's especially safe from gulls that would like to get the eggs and get in there and eat that puffling. But so it's just hidden away, safe back there in that dark subterranean chamber. But one day on instinct, it just goes out to sea. It has to fly, take its maiden flight all on its own. Its parents don't give it any help. It leaves under the cover of dark. It leaves at night so it can evade aerial predators like snowy owls, bald eagles, peregrine falcons, and it just flaps its little wings and flutters and does whatever it can, sort of stumbles off the edge of the cliff. And puffins have even adult puffins have a lot of trouble getting started flying, right? They've evolved, their wings have evolved to be like flippers so they can fly underwater and chase fish. And in the air, they can fly really fast, but getting started is always a challenge for a puffin. So when they're on the water, it can take up to 12 tries. You know, they're sort of running across the water trying to get started. And when they're on land, when they're in their burrows, they like to burrow on really steep cliffs. And what they do is they just sort of fall off the edge of that precipitous cliff. It looks like sometimes they're plummeting to their doom. But then at the last possible moment, they start beating those little wings as fast as they can, and away they go.
So, Steve, before we go much further, I know some of our listeners will have a mental image of a puffin, having seen pictures, and some probably have even seen them off our shores. But what does a tufted puffin look like?
Yeah, well, the tufted puffin is one of the most improbable-looking birds I think anyone could imagine. It's charming, it's clownish, it's charismatic, it's a little bit bizarre. So let's put the tufted puffin together. So we start with that bill. That's probably its most salient feature. It's got that big orange bill that makes it look kind of like a toucan or a parrot. It has a white face mask that makes it look a little bit like a rodeo clown. And the tufted puffin has beautiful golden curls that curl out of the sides of its head and down the nape
so
of
like
its neck.
Gigantic eyebrows.
Yeah. Really showy plumage there. And that's its breeding plumage, the way it attracts members of the opposite sex. And then its body shape is very interesting. A lot of times they're called flying footballs because they have that kind of fat, rounded football shape. They've got big, bright orange feet.
I read they were about the same size as a pigeon, but many times a pigeon's weight.
Yeah, let's say a really plump pigeon.
A
pigeon that's had a lot of good meals. Yeah, so they have a pretty funny body shape, or funny to us. It has some important evolutionary explanations for why they're shaped like that, which we can get into.
Do both the males and the female look the same?
Yeah, so the tufted puffin, puffins in general, don't have, they're not sexually dimorphic in the way we think of birds like, the peacock is, of course, a great example. Mm-hmm. The male peacock has extravagant feathers, and the peahen, the female, is relatively bland. Or maybe we'll think of the mallard, and the mallard male has all that beautiful plumage, mm-hmm. and the female is relatively dull. Not so with the tufted puffin. We really can't tell them apart. They both have that beautiful breeding plumage. So it's not males just trying to attract females. They have to attract each other. There's a slight difference in size. The males might be 5% larger, but we really wouldn't notice that. Maybe if they're standing next to each other and we looked really carefully, we might see that the male's slightly bigger.
And you've talked about breeding plumage. What do they look like when they're not in their breeding plumage?
Well, that's a funny thing because they're so extravagantly arrayed when they're near land and when we see them here, and we only see them from April till August, roughly. The rest of the year, they're out at sea. They're out in the North Pacific. And if we were to see them out there, we'd have to go a long way out, maybe 50 to 100 miles, and we probably wouldn't even notice them because they're a pretty drab bird. They lose those beautiful golden tufts that curl out from their head. They lose that brilliant orange color on their beak. Their bright orange legs and feet become relatively dull. They lose the black sheen of their feathers. They lose their white face mask. And get this, Nan, they even shed part of their bill. Part of that bill is considered just for breeding purposes.
You know,
actually falls off.
You talked a bit about that last Saturday, and I was thinking if you go to some of the Indigenous people's museums, you can see the bills that were used almost as rattles or as ceremonial fringe. I mean, it's really interesting, and I'm thinking that's clearly collected after they've shed them, I'm guessing.
Yeah. In places, sometimes you can go to aquaria like Seattle Aquarium or Newport Aquarium, and they might have those parts of the bill that they shed because the birds are there year round. And it's just one part of the bill. It's called the casque, C-A-S-Q-U-E. And it sort of fits over the top of the bill. And apparently to puffins, that's, it's part of how they indicate their fitness to breed, mm-hmm. how they attract each other. So that seems to be its purpose. And that's just shed at the end of the breeding season. I just thought that was phenomenal the first time I heard it. How strange, a bird shedding part of its bill.
Yeah, it is strange. In getting ready to go on this tufted puffin cruise on Saturday, kind of went online, and I want to share just kind of a weird little fact. The scientific name for the puffin, the genus name is Fratercula. Sounds like brother, sort of. And it comes from medieval Latin, from which the same word that friar comes from. And of course, that's the reference to the black and white plumage, the theory being resemblance of monastic robes. And then the specific or species name is cirrhata, which is Latin for curly-headed, which I think is kind of cute. Anyway, yes, scientific names can be useful and descriptive.
And fun. Yeah, isn't that fun? Yeah. I'm not a stickler for teaching scientific Latin, but
either.
I would be remiss in not telling people about their scientific name on those cruises. I think it's so much fun. And hey, so the cirrhata part of it comes from cirrus, which I know, Nan, mm-hmm. like me, I know you're someone who loves to go into the tide pools. And one of the things I like looking at are when barnacles open their shells and extend their cirri.
Which
yeah.
is the same sort of
right.
curly thing.
Yeah, the same curly thing. And then overhead, we might have some cirrus clouds. So fun with Latin. Tufted puffin is so cool that even its scientific name
is cool.
Is charming and cool. Yeah, it just gets better and better.
So why do you think so many people are just kind of enchanted by the puffins?
My first attraction to the puffin, like most people, you just see it and you think, here is an amazing looking animal. And I just couldn't believe that it lived here on the Pacific coast. And most people can't. You know, sometimes we joke around and call it the parrot of the Pacific. No relation to parrots, of course, but it just looks so strange to have this bird with a bright orange bill and all these strange breeding plumage features and this funny flying football out there. So it kind of attracts us with our charm. But then I kept coming back to it and learning more and more about it. And I hope other people do too, because the truth is it has an array of extraordinary adaptations that allow it to not only survive, but thrive amid some of the most ferocious conditions on planet Earth. It's highly evolved and very well adapted to live out there in the North Pacific. It spends 7 months of the year on the open ocean, making a living out there.
I'm remembering the first time I saw a puffin. It was on the coast of Oregon, down near Bandon. And we were just sort of hanging out on a bluff. And I saw this small bird go flying by, as you say, sort of this flying football shaped thing, madly beating these short little wings. And it was like, that looks like it has to be a puffin. I had never seen a puffin fly. I'd read a little bit about it, but it was like, oh, wow, this is so cool. They spend so much time at sea and they eat fish. How do they get those fish?
How do they get those fish? That's right. There's a lot of fish out there in the ocean. There's lots of food, but if you want to eat them, you got to figure out how to get down there and get them. So the tufted puffin has evolved. It's one among many members of a family of birds called Alcidae, or also known as the Alcids or the Auks, A-U-K, Auk. All those birds, they use their wings as sort of like stubby diving appendages, almost like flippers, almost the way a sea mammal would use flippers. kilometers to go beneath the ocean, and they literally fly beneath the water. And if you ever get a chance to see that, it's phenomenal. It really looks like they're flying beneath the water with their wings. Their feet don't come into play for propulsion. They simply use their feet for steering. They fan their tail to steer. So very different from a bird like, say, a loon or a grebe or a cormorant, which uses its big webbed feet for propulsion and tucks its wings. So that's kind of the puffins, and along with their auk cousins, one of their special adaptations that allows them to go down under the ocean and swim really well, so well that they're out swimming fish, which I think is phenomenal. A bird amazing. That can swim better than fish, multiple fish, cut them out of a school, gather them in its bill.
So you mentioned they were a member of the Alcid family. What other members are around here that listeners might be familiar with?
Yeah, and I think the tufted puffins, Alcid cousins, they're all just as cool, just as interesting as the puffin if we take a close look at them. A lot of people have probably seen pigeon guillemots around.
Mm-hmm. That's probably black bodies, red feet.
Yeah, those beautiful fire engine red feet. And they have that kind of funny flying thing you were talking about too, where you see them going through the air and you think, wow, there's a bird that probably is, hopefully it's doing better on the water than it does in the air. And when they land, they always have that kind of, it just looks like a real plop. Yeah, just a crash, a belly flop. It's not elegant at all. But once they dive under the water, you see those fire engine red feet disappear as they dive. Then they become very elegant and powerful. It's really beautiful to see them under the water. We also have the rhinoceros auklet. That's another one that's pretty common here. And
we saw those on Saturday. So why don't you take a moment and describe the rhinoceros auklet?
Yeah, so that's a really cool bird. And it's actually, you know, that's actually a puffin. Scientists now have determined that the rhinoceros auklet is so closely related to our friend the tufted puffin that it's actually its close cousin and literally a puffin. So they've considered that the fourth puffin. The other two puffin species are the Atlantic puffin and the horn puffin. And it turns out that the tufted puffin is more closely related to the rhinoceros auklet than it is to the other puffins. So that rhinoceros auklet, it doesn't look a lot like the tufted puffin, except if you start to look closely, you see that its body shape is really the same, right? It's almost identical. It's got that same kind of rounded football shape. It's got the little stubby wings that it just beats like crazy when it's flying. It has a bill that can hold multiple fish like the puffin, and it's got that great little sort of rhinoceros-like horn appendage on the end of its bill.
Kind of things.
And they shed those too, just the same way that the puffin sheds part of its bill after breeding season.
So other members of the Alcid family that we could see around here?
Yeah, what else do we have here? We've got the marble merlet, which is one of my favorite birds.
And we saw those, Saturday, which is like, it makes your heart spin, because those are the threatened and endangered species of the old growth forests.
That's right. They have that unique lifestyle where they breed in old growth forests, in ancient trees, on limbs of very large trees, way back in the forest, sometimes up to 50 miles inland. And so each day, they're still a seabird, so they have to make their living at sea, even though they have their home in the forest. So each day, they fly back and forth. That's a long commute, but they're an extraordinary bird and really cute. They're kind of a smaller auklet, and this time of year, we tend to see them in pairs, and they kind of do a synchronized diving. You can see the pairs sort of diving together. They're in their forest camouflage this time of year, because when they go back into the forest, they're hidden among the trees. Really mysterious bird. They were considered the enigma of the Pacific for a couple of centuries. Mm-hmm. Scientists just couldn't figure out where they bred. And in the 70s, finally, the mystery was solved, and they realized that they're, during breeding season, they're hidden back there in the ancient forests of the Pacific Northwest.
And they're really hard to see. In the forest, you've got to almost be there before dawn. I have only seen them once or twice on the water. I was really excited.
Yeah, wasn't that fun? That was quite a day.
Well, and you know, you talked about the rhinoceros auklets. We were seeing a number of them that had fish in their mouth, and we were getting oh so very excited. Why were we getting excited? And how do they do that?
Yeah. So
Because the tufted puffins do the same thing.
Right, yeah. And a lot of people have probably seen those iconic photos of puffins where they have multiple fish in their bills. So they have those little thin silvery fish, and they store them crosswise in their bills, and they sort of droop down at the side. So the puffin, not only does it have that parrot-like orange beak, but a lot of times it has silvery fish dangling off of it. They give it a look like it's wearing a silver mustache, kind of add more to its comic appeal. But the way the puffin does that is it has this really cool adaptation. So its bill is lined with little tiny hooks. It also has a raspy tongue, so it'll catch one fish and then move it around with its tongue and kind of stick it to those hooks on the back of its bill, and then it'll catch more fish fish.
They're crosswise on the bill.
Lined up crosswise on the bill, like a perfect little assembly line. The precision of it is quite striking. And they can carry 10 to 20 fish at a time. That's not uncommon. The record I've read is 62 fish. 62 fish in a puffin's bill.
That's a lot of fish.
Yeah, and they carry those fish. We're excited to see them carrying fish because that means they've got pufflings. They're taking those fish back to feed their young. Because an adult puffin, when it's under the water and it catches fish, it's just going to eat them. It's going to eat its meal there.
Yeah.
Yeah, so fish to go when it's carrying fish, that means there's a hungry puffling somewhere.
So we did not see the tufted puffin with fish, but we certainly saw those rhinoceros auklets with fish.
We sure did, yeah. Some of them were quite close to the boat carrying multiple fish in that beautiful evening light, and people got some extraordinary photos of that.
Oh,
that was really cool to see.
That was another amazing thing. I mean, the cruises are from 6 to 9, and that's when the light is low, and the brilliance of the birds was stunning, and the brilliance of the orange beaks and the coloration. Just, I had never seen anything quite like that. It was pretty amazing. Steve and I have a lot more to talk about, but Steve.
Yes?
Can we do a second show?
Let's do a second show.
Okay.
I'd love to.
Okay. Well, so let's wind up this show with a listen to the mystery sound. Well, it probably shouldn't surprise you in a program where we're talking all about puffins that deep growling kind of sound was an adult tufted puffin. And those sort of high-pitched whistles, which I will not attempt to sound like, those, of course, were the chicks. So you were hearing tufted puffins. Well, and we also need to point out some upcoming events. And as we mentioned earlier, every Saturday evening from now through August the 10th, you can go on a puffin cruise with the Puget Sound Express and the Port Townsend Marine Science Center. Google the Port Townsend Marine Science Center for details. You will not regret it. And, of course, there are other things to do now with our wonderful summer weather and lots of opportunities to go on outings and learn about the wonders of our natural habitat. And I've asked Steve to help me share some of the events with you.
The good folks with the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society are sponsoring a host of interesting upcoming events. On Saturday, July 6th, the Backyard Birding Class will focus on gulls and shorebirds. On Tuesday, July 9th, and Wednesday, July 10th, you can learn about flowers of the Olympic Peninsula. Then on Monday, July 15th, plan to join the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society for a field trip to Hurricane Ridge. Check their website for details.
I'll bet the flowers up in Hurricane Ridge are going to be gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous. Well, and the Olympic Peninsula of the Native Plant Society is hosting a field trip and an easy walk on Tuesday, July 9th, to explore the estuary and shoreline at Daybob Bay Natural Area. They'll carpool from Port Townsend and from Quilcene to visit this very special area, which is actually not normally open to the public. Representatives of the Washington Department of Natural Resources will be the special guides for this trip. And the website of the Olympic Peninsula of the Native Plant Society has all the details for this unique trip.
On Saturday, July 13th, join the Friends of Fort Worden for a trail work party. The trail team is doing cleanup after the recent fire mitigation mowing on Artillery Hill. Bring water, gloves, loppers, and pruning saws if you have them. Coffee, tea, and snacks provided. Meet at the parking lot near the School of Woodworking at 9:30 a.m.
And that's a fun group, and it's really hardly work, and it means so much to rehabilitate that fort we love so much. Well, that's it for this episode of Nature Now. We hope you've enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news and information about the natural community where we live. Many thanks to our steadfasting editing crew, and today's sound engineer and editor is Alex Hindley. Contact Nature Now hosts if you have comments, observations, or ideas. You can email us at naturenow, that's one word, naturenow@kptz.org. Nature Now airs at 12.05 p.m. on Wednesdays with repeats here on KPTZ, that's at 91.9 FM, on Thursdays at 5.05 p.m. and Saturdays at 12.30 p.m. Recent podcasts are also available on the KPTZ website. Thanks for listening. And our ending music today, by Wood Note and Jim Vincible, is The Puffin.